Welcome to Red Alert Radio, grassroots radio with an ear on the issues that matter to you. Hosted by your local Labor MPs.
And good morning, it's Phil Goff here, Labor MP for Mount Roskill, welcoming you to Red Alert Radio on Planet FM 104.6. Well, today I have a guest on the line who is a new Member of Parliament. Well, kind of new. He's been there for about 13 or 14 months now. But my guest is Dr. David Clark, who is the MP for Dunedin North. And David's made a real impact in Parliament in the short time that he's been there. I saw a report in the paper that said the name is a mixture, David Longy, Helen Clark, and he's taken a bit from both. But it's always dangerous when you're a new MP when people start saying nice things about you. And the particular article that I'm referring to, written by Vernon Small for the Sunday Star Times, says that David Clark is Labor's new rocket man. And I'm reading this, so taking it out of context. From the top of his shaven head and his geek chic black framed glasses to the sharp suits, and with a smart CV to match, the Reverend Dr. David Clark is on the move. Well, that's a hell of a title, David. Welcome to the program.
Goodness, yes, Phil. You don't want to read everything. You don't want to believe everything you read in the papers, of course.
Well, I'm just wondering, if you become a minister, will you be the Honourable Dr. David Clark? It's a bit too much, isn't it?
It does become quite a lot, doesn't it? Yeah.
But yeah. Look, you've got an interesting background coming to the Labor Party, David. I see that your mum was a GP, is that correct?
That's right, yeah. She spent most of her working life in Otara.
Oh, well, very good area. That was my early stamping ground in politics, selling meat raffles at the Otara market.
Indeed. I hear you're still occasionally seen out that way.
I am indeed. Yeah, no, it's a great place. Wonderful part of multicultural Auckland. And your dad was in manufacturing.
That's right. Yeah. In East Tamaki, he's still got a manufacturing business there and also an import business and a car painting business.
Okay, so your mum and dad are Aucklanders?
Yes, they are, yeah. And I grew up in Beachlands, a little village southeast of Auckland, and my folks are still there, so still got a connection back there.
Not so much a little village anymore, though. Part of the great sprawling mess of Auckland, and Nick Smith's going to make it worse, he tells us. Hey, but that's... So you've ended up in Dunedin. You did your university down there. And as part of your degree, you spent some time in Germany as an exchange student. So you speak German fluently?
I do, yeah. I did a high school year there. Instead of finishing, I didn't do what was then seventh form. I had a year in Germany at a high school and learnt German there. And so consequently learnt to speak without an accent, by and large. And then I went on and did a German degree at university, and finally following that did 6 months study there. So it's still kind of there, although that's a long time ago now. It still comes back reasonably quickly when I visit.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I launched recently a paper for the Royal Society on Languages Policy for New Zealand, where they're promoting people to learn second languages. And I looked at that and I thought, you learned it the right way. I did French at school for years and then on to university with it, but never got to speak fluently because I never lived in a country and learned it in the country where it was spoken. But you did your German that way. That must have been a huge advantage. Maybe we should be looking at teaching languages by sending Kiwis offshore and getting them to do a gap year in the country with the language they wish to learn.
By immersion, yeah, it's definitely the easiest way to learn it. I had to do battle through Latin and Russian and French, and at various points I think failed each of them consecutively at some point in my schooling career. And you know, there was still merit in doing those things as well, just for the background, and I think it's good for the brain. And I think it would be useful if we moved more and more towards Māori language, particularly for kids, you know, because an understanding of culture as well as language. I just don't think any language education is wasted.
No, I think the National Languages Policy is a really good idea, and if we were all fluent in another language, it does a lot of things for you in terms of how your brain works, how you learn, and all the evidence is there. And also part of being a sort of a global world that we live in, having people that can go overseas and promote New Zealand, maybe it's in trade or business or whatever, and speak in the language that they speak in that country, as against the usual arrogance of English-speaking people where we go to places and we expect them to speak in our language. But anyway, that's not what I was going to ask you about today. One of the other interesting parts about your background is that you were a Presbyterian minister for 3 years and presumably still are. And, you know, what with your sharp haircut, that led me to make some unfortunate parallels with Arnold Nordmeyer. I shouldn't say unfortunate.
A very flattering one, actually.
Yeah.
Bill, as I recall.
Yeah. Arnold Nordmeyer was a great Kiwi and a great finance minister and a great parliamentarian. I think he would have made a really good prime minister. But he got branded, of course, in 1958 with the black budget because he put the price of cigarettes up and of alcohol. Now, you're not a smoker, of course. I don't think we allow that in the Labour caucus. You drink occasionally, though, so you're not quite in the mould.
No, not quite in that mould. But you know, he was probably ahead of his time, I think, in hindsight. And you know, he was probably right. But he wasn't. He was willing to do what wasn't necessarily the popular thing. And so he's someone I have quite a lot of admiration for. He's someone that stood by his principle and was a very competent finance person as well before that. He's an outstanding character. It's a very flattering comparison, I have to say.
No, he's fantastic. I mean, people remember him for the black budget. Well, I don't know whether they do nowadays. It was a long time ago. But actually, we could have remembered him for free dental treatment for under 16-year-olds, for capitalisation of the family benefit, for investing in education. So, you know...
People I've met who met him, you know, long before I was politically aware, just say that he was a jolly nice guy and, you know, built his own house and a whole lot of other things that we would take pride in today. He had an ordinary touch as well as being an exemplary mind and did a lot of good for New Zealand society. So
He did absolutely. And
good,
you know,
good Presbyterian predecessor. I still am a Presbyterian minister and I am still associated with Knox Church down here in Dunedin, but obviously parliamentary and constituent business keeps me occupied most of the time, but I try to keep my hand in and certainly help out with friends and family with funerals and weddings and that kind of thing still. And that, you know, is good because it kind of grounds you in those everyday realities. You know, weddings and funerals are pretty important moments in people's lives, so it's a real privilege to be able to serve in that capacity from time to time.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of your religious faith, what do you think that brings to you in politics? How has that influenced the sort of person that you are and your desire to be active in politics?
Yeah, there's a surprising number, as you'll know, Phil, of people in the parliamentary environment and indeed senior civil servants who have, a service ethic and a desire to contribute to society, who come from some kind of faith background. And I've no doubt that plays a big part in it for me too. I grew up with a family that were concerned, although I wouldn't have known the label necessarily, with social justice issues. That has kind of stayed with me. I am concerned about the growing gap between rich and poor in New Zealand. You know, it's the worst it's ever been and it's growing. And it's a deliberate policy of this government when you look at the 2010 tax cuts where all the 44% of the value went to the top 10% of earners and the bottom 20% got just 2% of those tax cuts. We can see that there's a deliberate political ideology at play there that says if only the poor were poorer, they'd work harder and the country would be better off. And I frankly don't believe that and don't believe that the research evidence backs that up either. I think everybody needs enough to live kind of a decent life and to have, live with dignity, and then the evidence seems to be that if you can afford to buy a suit, then you can go to the interview and you're more likely to get a job, you know?
Yeah.
And also that preventable illnesses are costing the country a huge amount, you know, respiratory illnesses and the like. And so there's a whole lot of reasons why inequalities aren't working for us. They're very inefficient economically, aside from the obvious social harm they cause. And I guess that's one of the passions that has brought me to politics and to want to make a difference and to want to get involved is the thought that actually we need some deliberate policies that tackle the worst aspects of the inequality that we're facing and make sure that we have things like the minimum wage, and that's the bill, one of the bills I took to Parliament, so that we actually begin to address the poverty and the foolishness of it and the cost that places on the individuals as well as the taxpayer more generally.
Yeah, it's really a touchstone of Labour principles, isn't it, that we've got to have a fair society, a place where everybody gets a decent start in life, where everybody gets opportunity to be the best they can to realise their potential. And it's very hard when you look at the world today and you see, you know, I had the occasion to fly across part of the Auckland area by helicopter as one of my, going to a parliamentary function as leader of the opposition, and I looked down and I saw these massive houses sprinkled across the countryside between here and the Coromandel. And then I thought of the people that are struggling and will never probably be able to realise the aspiration, the dream of owning their own home. And I wondered, you know, I wondered where New Zealand society was going. I kind of got brought up in a different era, I guess, where people, my parents' generation, had come back from the war and everybody said, well, we sacrifice equally and therefore we share equally and what our society, what our community can provide for us. Not that people will be absolutely equal. Of course they won't. People who work harder, people who are smart, they'll do well. But you've got to have that basic, decent, minimum standard of living where people can get good health, they can get good housing, they can get the best education they can for their kids. And we're losing some of that. And it seems to me, just going back to my original question to you, the Bible I read kind of says that that was the sort of thing that that Christ believed in. He didn't hang about with the wealthy and the Pharisees. He stood by the people that had to struggle for life, and he talked of, you know, the harder for the wealthy man to get into the kingdom of heaven than a camel to pass through the eye of a needle, etc.
That's right. So much of the New Testament and the Bible is devoted to poverty and to injustice. And you know, I find it grossly ironic when church groups are lobbying on personal morality issues, for example, when we know that almost doesn't feature at all in the gospel story. It is really about the disadvantaged and those in poverty and facing difficult circumstances. So I think you're absolutely right. And perhaps there's no surprise then that the founders of the Labour Party believed that what they were founding was applied Christianity. That's how they described it.
Yeah.
And we in the Labour Party, you know, at times I think probably have forgotten that description, but I think it actually captures a lot of what we are trying to do. You know, the values that sit at the heart, even for those in the caucus who don't have a faith, are actually values inherited from our Western heritage, you know, the best parts of it that came through from Christianity, about making sure that everyone has the basics of life and the opportunity to give things a go.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about both the church that you're affiliated to and mine is that, you know, there's been a lot of fuss about gay marriage, for example, yet you make the comment that there's no particular reference in the Bible, and certainly not in the New Testament, to that. And you said that Jesus hung out with all sorts of retrobates, he lived with his mother till he was in his 30s and hung out with 12 blokes. What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, that's what the wags say. You know, I don't think there's any evidence to say he was gay. But that's exactly right. And in fact, the people that he's most well known for hanging out with were prostitutes and the like. You know, he wasn't someone who was too precious about hanging out with the right people. He was somebody who
recognised the humanity in everyone.
Exactly, yeah. Right. Exactly, and hit the nail on the head.
You also make the point that the Old Testament might have condemned homosexuality, but it also talked about stoning people to death for cutting their hair on the side of their heads or not sleeping outside the campsite when menstruating. So,
yes,
you know,
that's right.
you've got to see those things in context.
Verses with one another, you know.
Yeah.
The references that to homosexuality and cutting the hair on the side of your head are literally in the same breath, and they both require a death sentence if you're going to be biblically literal.
Yeah.
And you know, cutting the hair on your side of your head, I think, is pretty common now, and if everyone had to be stoned to death for that, there wouldn't be much in New Zealand left, would there?
We'd all be growing all the hair we could.
Right.
But I think those are interesting points. So what was the thing that led you directly into politics? You made that you've followed on from Pete Hodgson, who was your predecessor as Member of Parliament, and you'd worked in Parliament, of course. You'd been in Treasury, but you'd also worked for David Parker when he was a minister. Was it that sort of a experience in the parliamentary environment that led you to want to become an MP?
Yeah, it was a wee bit. My time at the Treasury was an interesting introduction to the public service and a sense of what government does, or a closer up kind of feel for things, having spent some time in university and church ministry before that, and in various kind of, you know, labouring jobs over the holidays as a student and so on, that kind of perspective. But coming in closer into the public service and having a look at it, I found at times things a wee bit frustrating at arm's length advising at Treasury, and thought I'd have a look closer up in when I went to work in David Parker's office. And I was there about 16 months, so not a hugely long period of time, but it was long enough to get a sense of how the environment works and to see that real positive change is possible if you're prepared to work hard and understand the issues and get stuck in close to where the decisions are made. And so that time for me was about two things. One, discovering whether I thought it was possible to make a difference, and two, working out whether I thought that I would survive or thrive in that environment, because it's a pretty robust environment, Parliament, as you'll know from your years there.
Got a few scars.
And it's not for everybody.
No.
So I wanted to make doubly sure that it was an environment I thought I could contribute positively to and survive in before I threw my hat in the ring. And then a job came up in Dunedin at Selwyn College that I'd long coveted, and I disappeared off there thinking, well, one day when the opportunity comes up, I would like to put my hat in the ring. And it came up a little bit sooner than I was expecting. I was expecting Pete Hodgson to probably do another term. But he chose, and I admire him for doing it, he chose his time to finish. Not every politician gets to do that. He chose his time and said, no, I've made my contribution, I want to move on. And so then it was up to me to put my hat in the ring a bit sooner than I'd expected, knowing that if I didn't throw it in then, the opportunity might not come up again.
That's history. That's very true. Now, you and your wife, Katrina, have got two children. In fact, I remember you taking leave just before Christmas for the birth of your youngest child.
Yeah.
How do you find, I think back to my own experience, but, you know, politics is something that demands every minute of your time or will take every minute of your time. But young families are very, demand a lot of time. Children like to see their dad as they're growing up. How do you find, doing that, being available to your constituents, working hard as you do, because that's how you make an impact in politics, but still getting enough time for your family?
Well, yeah, quite frankly, I think, there's probably many others, and I'm sure you'd say this too, Phil. I think that's the hardest part of the job, is trying to get that balance with family right. And that feeling that you constantly can't do everything, so you're juggling. Of all of the challenges in politics and the little over a year I've been in it, the trying to make sure that you spend sufficient quality time with your family is the biggest challenge of all, and the hardest thing, because you do end up making some sacrifices, and you know that they're personal sacrifices for other people. When you're the politician, you're right there where the decisions are being made, and there's the cut and thrust of it, even in opposition, although I'm sure much more so when you're in government. And it's the family often that bears the cost. So I try to keep my family out of the spotlight, because I think politicians' families really pay a high price often for the involvement of their loved one in politics. But inevitably, there are sacrifices that they end up making, and not often of their own choosing.
Yeah, it's a sad thing that your children will, as mine did, often think, God, I wish my dad was doing something where he wasn't on television and bringing me into the spotlight. People then have expectations of your children, which may be unfair, and put a lot on them. But, you mentioned before that you took the opportunity when Pete Hodgson stood down, and good management, hard work, determination, commitment, all of those things are important in politics, but so too is good luck. And I've got to say, there is one area where you have been exceptionally lucky. I have gone 30 years in politics and never had a private member's bill drawn out of the ballot, and you in the first 12 months managed to get two, which won the admiration and maybe even the resentment of some of your colleagues. But let's have a quick look at those bills. The first bill, and you've touched on it already, was the bill for the minimum wage, about setting the minimum wage at $15 an hour. And I think the government's just put the minimum wage up by 25 cents an hour to $13.75. But, you know, surely as a country we can afford to pay people who work hard and do a good week's work a wage that they can hope to live on. And how the hell do you live on $13.75 an hour?
That's right. I think we can't afford not to pay them $15 an hour. That's the real truth of it. The families that you knock on doors, certainly in Dunedin, I knock on doors and they've done this leading through the winter, and you see kids come to the door with a runny nose and the house is cold, you know, you talk to the parents and they're working hard, you know. One of them will be working full time, the other one might be getting a bit of work here and there and looking after the kids. And they have to make a choice. Do I feed the kids or do I turn on the heater? Mm. And that's not a choice that families should be having to make, because there are costs of not doing either.
Yeah.
And those costs are borne by that family, often by generations that follow, and also by all the taxpayers. You know, these I mentioned earlier, preventable health conditions and so on. You know, respiratory illnesses are very, very high in New Zealand, much higher statistics than they should be. And part of that is poor, low quality housing. I mean, I'm really glad that Labor's announced some bold plans to build 100,000 new homes, but also that we've said there's going to be a regulatory rule that rental accommodation insulation standards.
I think that's really important, and even more so in your patch, I guess, in Dunedin. You get seriously cold winters down there.
That's right. So those kinds of things make a lot of sense. But, you know, in Australia, the minimum wage varies across sectors, but at the very minimum, it's around $20 New Zealand. You know, that's a different scale to what we have here. And what it does when the wage goes up is it forces employers to make sure that they are getting wealthy on the back of clever business, of investing in products that are high-value products, not getting wealthy off the back of cheap labour. And that means that, you know, your industries are more sustainable. I mean, I've often used the example down here I've talked with the local Chamber of Commerce and Business outfit down here to say, you know, because they wrote an article to the paper saying, or when there was an article, they said, $15 minimum wage will be hard for business. Well, it's not a great bump up, and actually most small employers, certainly locally here, pay a little bit more than the minimum wage. Yeah. They might pay $15 or $16 an hour already because they know how hard it is for the people to feed their kids, to get the basics of life covered.
Yeah.
And they're also very dependent on one or two staff. Now, bigger businesses don't necessarily do that. The kind of franchisee ones from overseas often pay absolute minimum wage and don't stress too much about what that means further down the track. Now, it actually levels the playing field when those bigger businesses have to pay the same kind of wages that those smaller ones do.
Yeah.
And that makes it easier for smaller businesses to succeed and thrive. And often they're New Zealand-based businesses and they pay good tax here and we all benefit. So there's actually some strange incentives in there, and when you look at things a bit more closely, you can see that it may well be good for New Zealand on a prima facie case to raise the minimum wage, obviously not to $40 an hour overnight or anything like that. That would be hard for any business to cope with, but to sensibly increase it over time makes sense. And I mean, through your time, Pete Hodgson used to remind me, through Labor's time in government and National's time in government, if you look through the 90s under National, the minimum wage went up 70 cents in 9 years, and unemployment soared. Then under the last Labor government, it went up $5, you know, much more generous increase in the minimum wage, and unemployment went to the lowest in the Western world. So some of these arguments you hear about wages going up meaning loss of jobs, it just doesn't follow.
Economists don't
fully understand how that whole thing works.
Yeah, if you look at how to stimulate your economy, the last thing you do is give the tax cuts to the people at the very top and make it really hard for people at the bottom, because of the people at the bottom, every dollar they get, they spend, that keeps your economy moving. People at the top, well, you know, they'll hop on a plane and go overseas and have a good holiday or stick the money somewhere. So even in terms of getting your economy moving, giving fair wages, a living wage to people that are on low incomes at the moment is clearly the right thing to do. The other bill that you introduced was an interesting one. The minimum wage one failed, of course, with the government voting against
it. Government voted it down.
Yeah, yeah. You know, if it's hard for somebody on $400,000 a year to understand why somebody should get paid $15 an hour, I guess. But the other bill was about when Waitangi Day and Anzac Day fall on a Saturday or a Sunday, which is obviously twice every 7 years, that while we'd still celebrate Waitangi Day on February the 6th and Anzac Day on April the 25th, you'd get a day off in lieu on the Monday so that you'd get the same number of statutory holidays each year in the same way that if Christmas Day falls on a Saturday or a Sunday, you get a Monday or a Tuesday off in lieu of that. And that bill, tell us about the progress of that bill.
Well, that bill, hopefully, if all things go well, should be law soon. Its second reading is before Parliament at the moment, and I've been assured that it will be voted for appropriately by the necessary parties. So, assuming everyone turns up on the day and so on, it should be through to law by the end of this year. So, I'm
will National
very pleased
support
about
that?
National won't. I mean, that's the interesting thing, Phil. They are onto a loser here. Even their own cheerleaders are saying this is nuts. You know, this is something many employers support. In fact, the only survey that's been done of businesses showed that 50% of employers supported it outright, mm-hmm. and a further 37% felt neutral about it. So 87% of employers either feel neutral about it or support it, because I guess lots of the employers' partners work in other firms, and they want to be sure that when they get a holiday, they can they can spend time with them too. You know, and employers generally are fair people. There'll be some who are rascals, like in anything, but a lot of employers understand that New Zealanders depend on 11 public holidays a year. On the odd year where they miss out, they feel it. Of course they do. If you get 9 public holidays instead of 11, it feels like a strange year. So some employers already do it. They already do a day in lieu. And most employers think it's a fair thing to do. It's actually only 2 days every 7 years. But those days, those few days we get every year with our families, you know, friends and family to spend quality time are valued because people work long hours in New Zealand.
I think that's great, and I think it's a good piece of legislation, and really proud that you and the Labor Party have been promoting that. We're just about out of time, but we have got just a couple of minutes left to talk about one of your other responsibilities now, which is you're on the Commerce Select Committee, and you're looking at economic development. But in recent weeks, you've had some of the state-owned enterprises in front of you, Mighty River Power, and you've had Solid Energy. And I've got to say, I was pretty amazed at the attitude and the arrogance of both of those state-owned enterprises at not answering questions.
Yeah.
And also at the huge double standard of the former chief executive of Solid Energy, who had, together with the downturn in coal, seen the company go into huge debt, $369 million, but they've given him a payoff of $100,000 a month for the next couple of months to be available on the phone if needed to talk to the new boss. That just seemed to me to be wrong. Tell us a little bit about that. Yeah. You've got about 1 minute to do it.
Right. Well, you know, I think, you know, we can only talk in broad brush strokes in that minute, but, you know, Don Elder's on $1.3 million salary, and they've just carried him on that, you know, and he doesn't seem to be required to do very much. And, in fact, it looked like the board were blocking his attendance. It wasn't clear that he didn't necessarily want to come, but they were stopping him coming along because it might be embarrassing to have him questioned at Select Committee. Now, that's kind of crazy stuff when he's the only one that actually knew what happened during the demise, or one of the few people that were in the room with ministers. I guess they're protecting John Key and others from the embarrassment of what's happened. And likewise with Mighty River Power. I mean, shocking when they came before Select Committee and refused to answer a whole lot of questions that we ask on behalf of taxpayers. Every other state-owned enterprise, you know, answered the questions in good faith, they looked for reasons not to answer them. And that kind of speaks of an arrogance of those companies. And, you know, I guess they think they're going to be privatised and all of that, and they don't need to worry about the taxpayer anymore. Currently, those assets are owned by all New Zealanders, and it's a tragedy, but they're going to be sold off.
That's absolutely right. An incredible arrogance encouraged by the government that they shouldn't front up, they shouldn't be accountable. And, of course, when they're privatised, they won't be. And that's a real tragedy for all of us. When, you know, things like Mighty River Power will probably sell it at the bottom of the market, but in future times that will cost us dearly in lost dividends and in the higher prices that people will charge for power. Hey, David, great to have you on the program today. Thank you very much for making the time available.
Thanks for having me on, Phil. I've really enjoyed the chat.
Yeah, good luck with the rest of your parliamentary career, and we'll catch up with you again. Love to have you on the program again when you're available.
Thanks, Phil.
This is Phil Goff on Red Alert Radio on Planet FM 104.6. We'll catch you next week.
Get together with your local MP next week at 9:05 a.m. Or listen online anytime on planetaudio.org.nz/RedAlertRadio.